All right, good afternoon. Education Finance Committee will finally come to order. Today we're going to hear two bills, one Representative Fenton, one is mine, and mine will be for informational purposes today. But before we do that, Representative Poston, I appreciate your presence prompt as always. If you've had a chance to review the minutes.
Madam Chair, I have reviewed the minutes and I motion to move them.
All right. Representative Poston moves to approve the minutes from February 22nd. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motions are approved, or minutes are approved. Thank you very much, Representative Poston. All right. Representative Fenton. Thank you, Representative Fenton. Glad to have you back before the committee. And I will just move your bill to get it before us. I would move that House File 1380 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time. And with that, you are recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and thank you for the opportunity to present House File 1380. What this does is it expands grant funding for teacher residency programs. And I authored this bill last session that provided funding to three residency programs, and today we're going to hear from two of them. As we've all heard, if you've probably had meetings with the local school districts in which you represent, recruiting and retaining teachers, particularly in certain fields such as special education, bilingual education, math, and science, has become a real challenge. And as some of you know, I worked on implementing alternative certification or teacher licensure when I lived in Texas. And the alternative licensure programs actually provide new entry points into teaching profession for non-traditional candidates. And when implemented well, they do help reduce the barriers to entering the profession. But today we're going to hear about something that's a little bit different, the non-conventional pathway teacher residency program, or some call it the Grow Your Own. And as we're experiencing shortages in schools and districts across our state, where can you find people that would be make great teachers? Well, they're right under your nose in the school building. So the Grow Your Own programs open the door to licensure for paraprofessionals, educational assistants, and others who are already serving our students in the classroom in some way. And this approach has two key benefits. The first is higher retention rates, because the support staff who get licensed have served in the classroom prior to getting licensed, and they know what to expect. And nationally, the data is clear. The teacher who goes through the residency program stay in the teaching profession at a much higher rate, 80 to 85%, than the teachers who go through traditional teacher preparation programs. The second key factor is residency programs help diversify our teacher corps. So school support staffs are often our district's most diverse staff groups, creating pathways into the teaching profession for our school support staff will help the schools develop a more diverse group of teachers. So today you're going to hear from two programs that are working with the University of St. Thomas and the University of Minnesota. And my goal is to take the best practices being developed by these programs and make them available to districts across the state. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my very first testifier, Danae Franke.
Hi.
Hi, welcome. And to all the testifiers, if you would just state your name at the beginning of your testimony, then we'll have it on the record.
Okay.
So, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Hello, Madam Chair. My name is Danae Franke, and I work in the St. Paul Public Schools, and I'm the coordinator of the SUTER program. It's the St. Paul Urban Teacher Residency Program. And thanks to your funding from last year, we were able to launch a residency program this year. And you'll hear later from one of our residents and one of our mentors about the experiences that they're currently having. As an overview of residency programs, residencies look different than traditional student teaching programs because a resident gets to spend the whole year in a classroom co-teaching with a mentor teacher in the building. So in our particular program for SUTER, residents start in June of the year that the program starts, and they take classes all of June, Monday through Thursday, for about 6.5 hours in the afternoon and evening so that they can also continue getting some money in the mornings by teaching summer school. During the school year, they come into the classrooms. Tuesday through Friday, they student teach throughout the whole year. They open the classroom with the teacher, and they close the classroom with the teacher. On Mondays from 9 to 4, they continue their coursework in completing their standards of effective practice classes. Then the following summer, they take a little bit more coursework, and they also complete a master's project. So SUTOR residents in our program complete the program in 15 months. They have a master's and a teaching license. Our first cohort, which launched in June, has 22 residents. 14 of them will be graduating with a special ed ABS license. Come June, they'll be applying for their license. 8 of them are elementary candidates. 60% are teachers of color. 50% are men. Our program goal is to recruit high-quality candidates to prepare them, to train them, and to retain them. Another goal we have is to interrupt systems, to do things different within the district and within the university partnership. And we feel very strongly that we've been able to do this with this program. Our residents are wonderful. Our mentors are wonderful. We take our mentors once a month and we provide mentor PD for them so they really learn how to mentor, how they learn how to have difficult conversations, how to really coach our residents to be successful. Our reports and our data is showing right now that everybody working in the program is very satisfied and they feel like they'll be a really good, strong, quality teacher. Our rigorous selection process has yielded us with a group of teachers that are affecting the students of St. Paul Public Schools. So with that said, I want to say thank you for the help that you have given us to launch this program. It has removed the barriers of time and money for several of our residents, and our mentors also report that this program is enhancing their practice. So I'll, at this time, turn it over to one of our residents, Mario Luna, and he will tell you his experience.
Thank you, Ms. Frankie. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mario Luna, and right now, yes, I am a SUTOR resident. Right now, I'm at Battle Creek Junior High, and so a little bit about my experience is when I signed up for this program, I definitely went into it thinking that they wanted minority teachers to teach minority students, and I later found out, by taking our equity class, that it's more than that. This is a program that, like, kind of how they said that they're experiencing that teachers are coming into the system not knowing how to manage behaviors or work with students that grew up in St. Paul or Minneapolis or in the cities, and it's not just sit down and be quiet and listen, and so it's this working with the students that they're looking for. And so people who do that, I was a paraprofessional for 2 years at Humble High School, and I learned how to work with the kids because I was one of the kids. I was that kid in St. Paul that really didn't think education or school was meant for me, or that I was going to go on and go to college. But it was the teachers that I had that really pushed me to step up and to really become the student that I am. And I went to school, got a four-year education. In 4 years, I didn't take any extra time. And now when I got out, I thought, well, I've always looked up to those teachers, why not become one? So I started working as a paraprofessional, and then I found this program. And this program really has molded me into taking this thing that I learned in school to how to work with kids and how to learn in all these different ways that I had to teach myself or learn from my teachers, and use that something that I received, and now I can pass on. And so this opportunity has really opened my eyes to what I want to do in life and what I want to achieve, and how helping these kids that may learn a little different than everybody else, but that doesn't mean that we can't find how they learn and push them to think like I think now, that I can be something other than just, you know, graduated high school and that's it. So that's why I really like SUTOR.
Thank you, Mr. Luna. And so, quick question for me: Were you invited to join the program, or did you hear about it and say, you know, hey, I think I'm interested in this? How did you get involved in the SUTOR program?
Yeah, thank you. I learned about the SUTOR program from my principal when I was a paraprofessional, because I was looking for ways to get back into so I can get my teaching license, because I graduated with a degree in public relations, so it wasn't necessarily the career path I chose, but it helped me in the long run. But yeah, so I heard about Souter through my principal, and when I applied, just signed up, and it was an easy process, but it was nice. The interview process was very rigorous and really different, and it was cool to not just sit down and answer a bunch of questions. We had to give a cultural autobiography, and we had to read an article that was about culturally responsive teaching and how that's changing over the time, and it's not just the same way that we're doing things, and how we thought about that, and we had a discussion. So the interview process was really eye-opening to showing me that this program was more than just, hey, come to school and get a degree.
That's great. Well, it's exciting. And what are your career goals now?
I'd like to, I'm in the special ed program for Souter. So I'd like to work in a junior high because I think I have the energy to deal with those crazy kids.
There's but, a special place in heaven for you.
Yeah, so I've been told. But yeah, and so it's fun. I like it. It's where I'm at right now. I'm in the seventh grade co-taught English class, and I'm right now I'm teaching a Read 180 class that I've taken over along with my mentor teacher. And it's something I really enjoy. I love it. I like going to work. I haven't taken a personal day or a sick day or anything like that. It's something I want to do, and I want to teach junior high. So, yeah, my career goal would probably be somewhere in St. Paul teaching junior high.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Representative Murphy has a question for you.
On that point, Madam Chair, do you get a choice, or do you, sometime during the Souter program, do you get to find out what elementary kids are, pre-elementary or high school kids, in addition to your middle school experience?
We graduate with a K-12 license. So we do get experience, and we go, I went to a high school, Johnson High School, for a period of time, and so then I'll get high school experience, and then in the spring I'll do that in elementary as well. So I will get an experience of all kids, or of all age groups, so my focus is junior high, so I am getting a lot more experience in junior high, though.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think first I just want to say thank you, Representative Fixon, for bringing this bill, chief authoring this bill. This is something that we have talked about a lot, in creating those pathways for more teachers of color to get into the classroom. And so it's good to hear your energy, and that you are enjoying the process. The question I have is, once you complete the program, will you continue to have a mentor?
Mr. Lynn?
Through the St. Paul Public Schools, there is like a first year kind of probationary period anyway that where we would get kind of a mentor. But I completely feel comfortable in asking my mentor teacher now any questions I will have in the future. Yes, he won't. I don't believe he'll be my official mentor to guide me through, but he's a resource that I have found and that I will definitely call upon for probably my whole career.
Thank you. And I think Ms. Frankie has something to add to that. Ms.
Mario
Frankie.
Doesn't know yet, because as he enters into the spring, we will be starting our induction seminars, and then we do have an induction period of 3 years that we're partnering up with St. Paul Public Schools to continue some strong support for our residents as they go into their first 3 years of higher in St. Paul, because we believe that it's extremely important to keep our teachers as we train them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I applaud you for this. I think this is great work. I have a couple questions regarding the type of license that they come out with. Under the Souter program, did I understand you correctly to say that there was they graduate with like a bachelor's and a master's? They have to come into the program with a bachelor's. They end the program with a master's and a teaching license.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Sandstead,
Madam Chair. The license that they would come out of the program with, I think the other testifier mentioned it was a K-12 license. Is that a new type of a license or a specialty license?
So Mario's one of our 14 that will graduate with special education ABS, Academic Behavioral Strategist license, and that is a K-12 special ed license that after 5 years he will have to go back and do a deep dive license to solidify the area in which he wants to get his license, so either LD or EBD, ASD or DCD.
Thank you, Ms. Hanson. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Representative Thiessen?
Yeah, I was just wondering how much of the grant, how much does St. Paul get?
I forgot to say my name before. We received $500,000 from you last year. We also have some money from a federal grant that got us started, the National Center of Teacher Residencies, who is guiding us along our work to make sure that we're building a really strong program.
Representative Easton?
And Madam Chair, just, and maybe this is for the author at the end at some point, but so how many school districts have more than 40% minority students? How many qualify for this grant?
I believe it's currently 21.
Ms. Frankie? 21?
This is the number I'm aware of.
Okay.
For 40%.
Right.
Thank you, then.
Okay, wait, we can have Mr. Shum or
Madam Chair.
President Fenton.
I just want to add something to Representative Thiessen's question regarding how much St. Paul received. When we implemented the when this bill went through last year, the funding request was $1.5 million. So they got a significant. But with the two, with University of Minnesota, the Minneapolis schools, St. Paul schools, and University of St. Thomas, we've increased it as the program is growing to $3 million.
Why
the difference
this
time?
Representative Thiessen.
And Madam Chair, no, that's very helpful. I didn't know if it was like three school districts would. If it's 21, it seems like I just don't know how many. So not all school districts that qualify are getting money. I'm just trying to understand that.
Right, and I'll just ask Mr. Strom if he can confirm that, or maybe he can get back to us on how many districts would qualify. So, right. I think we have one more testifier. Oh, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, I wanted to say to the testifier, Mr. Luna, is it?
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say I came in a little bit late, and I just heard your testimony, and you're just beaming when you're talking, and I just want to say how refreshing it is to see when somebody finds their passion in life. And so congratulations. You found it early, and I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so I think we've got a few more testifiers, so we should probably get them up. And
right now I have Martin Odima.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Martin Odima, Jr. Thank you for listening to me today. Just to give you a background, I am a special education teacher at Frost Lake Elementary. I work in the fifth grade, on the fifth grade team. I co-teach, which means that I work in two classrooms and I provide support. I work and I take team with the general ed teacher to make sure that all students have access to the curriculum. So students with a wide variety of abilities. I work with the general education teacher to make sure that everybody's learning. I was born in St. Paul. I went to the University of Minnesota and got a bachelor's in psychology. I got my license at St. Thomas University, and I went to the Collaborative Urban Educator Program, a little bit similar to the SUDA program, and got my master's at St. Thomas. After that, while I was getting my master's, I got a job at Frost Lake, and I've been working there for 4 years. I think that the SUDA program is a great program. It provides, if there's an impact on the students, there's an impact on the teachers that the SUDA residents are working with, and also there's an impact. I think that the SUDA residents have a great experience working in the schools, an immersive experience.
Thank you. So, Mr. Odima, so you went and you studied psychology, and then obviously you're now on a pathway or you're teaching. Did you do something else before you decided to get into teaching, or did you move into the paraprofessional role as an initial job?
That's a good question. So right when I got out of high school, I knew that I loved working with kids. I worked at the Midway YMCA as a before and after school counselor, and I realized that the students I was working with, some of the students were special ed students. And I was recommended by the school that was near the Midway YMCA. Said, hey, you should work at this school. You should be a teacher assistant. So I got a job as a teacher assistant at Hancock Elementary and got experience working in the program there. And then I was really lucky because the staff there supported me. They advocated for me to be a teacher. And I learned about the Q program, and they helped me. They guided me to get my license and my master's.
Great, excellent. Representative Sanstead.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And exactly to that comment, again, I just want to recognize how much I appreciate the fact that this bill has a license component to it. So at the end of it, your teachers are coming out with a license. So when these adults are going into the classroom, they are equipped, they are licensed to be working with students to improve education. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Any other questions for this witness? Representative Thiessen. Oh, and Representative Thiessen, we do have an answer to the question that was raised earlier, thanks to our wonderful nonpartisan staff. Of the 332 school districts in Minnesota, 40 have more than 40% students of color. Thank you, Mr. Strong. All right, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. How many schools are part of this program right now?
Right now, the Grow Your Own program is implemented in the Minneapolis Public Schools and with the St. Paul Public Schools. The intent, though, is to bring this same program to school districts throughout the state. In the first year for Minneapolis, I think 26 residents, and it had about 75% diversity. And the purpose of the program is to increase the diversity pool of our teaching staff so children see role models just like themselves. So it's in the very early stages.
So the idea with the new money would be to expand it to other districts as opposed to expanding in St. Paul, Minneapolis?
That as well as there's an expansion for to go into more of the specialty where we have areas of shortage, like special education is one of them. So both purposes.
And then one other question. So you get the money pays for a stipend that goes to you? To the teacher, but yes, sorry, yes, thank you. And then you use that to pay tuition to St. Thomas. Is that kind of how it works, essentially? Or?
Mr. Luna.
Yes. We get a stipend. It comes in like a 2-week check, kind of like a paycheck. I'm using that, to pay for tuition, and then as well as like groceries and things like that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Thiessen, part of the reason for the stipend is many of these paraprofessionals in these schools would not be able to afford to do this if they didn't have anything at all while they're doing their practicum teaching in the classroom.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, and I guess that was my question, because the stipend is almost as much as the tuition, but I suppose the tuition you can take loans out and stuff.
We have to, because in the summer we don't get the stipend, just during the school year. So that first summer tuition I had to take out a loan, and then now I'm kind of back paying it, so yeah, before it gets interest.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, and did you have additional testimony?
To keep on track with time, we are going to bring up Fadumo Robel to be our final testifier.
All right. Ms. Robel, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Fadumo Robel with the Minneapolis Residency Program. I'm a resident. I'm working towards my K-6 elementary teacher license, and only after 6 more credits I will be able to get my master in education. What this one-year residency program opens the door to is the chance to serve the public schools, students to be part of the process to close achievement gaps in the Minneapolis district, and most definitely to increase the number of teachers of color. There is a need of diverse teachers throughout the states of Minnesota, particularly within the Twin Cities. A residency program like the MRP need to be funded and expanded. I worked for the Minneapolis Public School for the past 10 years as an associate educator. I worked directly with students and with families. Each year, the principal of Barton Open School, which is the school I worked at as an associate educator, Steve DeLapp was his name, and his staff encouraged me to get my teaching license. However, one of the biggest challenges I personally faced was funding. Going to school to become a teacher was my dream. And being able to afford the high tuition of the traditional program was impossible for me. The residency allows me the benefit to benefit from a reduced tuition compared to traditional program. It allows me to gain a high quality education combined with a strong year long teaching experience. This residency program supports me and my peers in building a career that needs people like me with previous schools experience to get to the front line of teaching and acquiring the experience and courses needed to become strong teachers. Looking at my kindergarten classroom, which I co-teach with a veteran teacher, gives me each day the confidence and the pride to be tomorrow's proud teacher. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Robley. That's wonderful. And I'm so pleased that you're pursuing the path of being a teacher, a licensed teacher in our schools. Any questions for this witness or for any of the witnesses so far? Ms. Sanseed, or Representative Sanseed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have just one question related to the author of the bill. Do you find or do you think that having people enter this program, having the requirement that they have a bachelor's, is impeding getting teachers of color into programs like this rather than maybe having them earn a bachelor's in the process?
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Sanstein. Actually, the participants of this program are already working in the schools. So from that perspective, I don't think so. But it's just great to identify those working around you, already working with our kids, who say, you know what, I want my own classroom someday, and open that door for them. So, and that's the purpose of the Grow Your Own. You're always identifying those people within your own school buildings of who would be great in the classroom and encouraging them to participate.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can I add a little bit more to that?
Yes, Ms. Robley, please.
I have a lot of friends who work for the district as an associate educator, and they would love to have the same chance that I had. You're right, bachelor is also an extra step too. And I'm one of the lucky ones to have that. But there are also the groups that don't have that license and have an associate educator and will love to become a teacher and serve the district too. So in that sense, it will be helpful too.
That's a good point. Maybe there's a way to create another pathway there too. Representative Fenton.
Madam Chair, and I think I agree that the program is very new, and as it grows and expands, I think those are things that the Grow Your Own program can start to look at as well.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to clarify the path that Mr. Odina took. Mr. Odina, you had your bachelor's degree, and
right.
Somebody suggested that you'd be really good with kids.
Right. So I was in school.
Mr. Odina.
I was actually going to go into business, and I was about to go into business school, and my wife said I was crazy. And
listen to your wife.
So I dropped out. Before the class even started, or before my course even started, I dropped out, and I continued to work with kids. And I kept on working as a teacher assistant at the school in St. Paul. And that's when I heard about the Q program. And they said, the teachers I worked at the school said, you need to do this. And my wife said, you need to do this, because you are good with kids.
Okay. Representative
Murphy. Madam Chair, then the Q program, when you started working with the Q program,
okay. You
didn't have to have more than a degree.
Mr. Odima.
Or did you have to be referred to the program?
I believe you needed to have at least a bachelor's degree to be in the program.
Okay.
To be considered, yes.
And that's what you had?
I had a bachelor's degree in psychology, yes.
And then, at what point did you get your license, and at what point did you get your master's degree?
I was able to work, do my student teaching at the school I was a teacher assistant at. So while I was a teacher assistant, I was able to get into the Q program, do my student teaching at that school, and I was able to get hired when my licensure was done. I was able to get hired right away, even before the school year was over, get hired to work at Frost Lake Elementary. So it was great. It was perfect.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Representative Murphy.
That clarifies, and I really appreciate that you did that.
Yeah.
And you just love the student teaching experience?
I think it's...
Mr. Odima.
It is a powerful... It's powerful within our school, because now, halfway through the school year, my student teacher and I can work dynamically with meeting the student needs. So think about last year, if I'm by myself, I'm trying to work in two different classrooms, trying to meet a bunch of needs for all the students. But now there's two of me, and we can think strategically where we can, what students we can work with. Maybe I work on delivering a lesson, and my student teacher does the progress monitoring, the assessment part. And then we can be interchangeable. So today when I left today, it was no issue because he's used to working with the kids that, you know, that are our students. So it's really dynamic. The fact that pretty much by the halfway through the school year, that there's really two of me in that grade level. And the same thing for second grade, with there's a suitor teacher there, suitor resident there too.
And
okay. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, what is your class enrollment?
So just to clarify, I'm a mentor teacher. And can you say your question again? Sorry.
What is the enrollment in your class that you're responsible for?
Mr. Odima.
So as a special ed EBD teacher at Frost Lake Elementary, my responsibility is for the whole entire general ed classroom and the special ed students. So I go into that classroom and I'm just like another teacher. The general education teacher and I share the 28 students who are in that class. And when I go to the other classroom, we share all those students. So they're all our responsibility.
The same 28, Madam Chair? The same 28 children?
Mr. Odina.
So I work in two classrooms. One classroom has 26 students. The other classroom has 28. And I go back and forth throughout the day.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And
Representative Murphy.
One more question for Ms. Roble. How many students in your kindergarten class?
Ms. Roble.
24 students.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is probably for the author. You talk about expanding the program, and that's what the extra monies are for, so my curiosity is killing me, because I'm thinking my area is a prime place for this, and where are you thinking about expanding it to?
Representative Fenton.
Okay, so as I was rolling my chair up, Madam Chair,
could you
repeat the question, Representative Tice?
No problem, Madam Chair, Representative Fenton. Paul, are you coming to St. Cloud?
I know that these the universities working with these students in schools would love to expand to where the needs are.
Representative Tice.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. My next question is, what do I need to do?
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Tice. I can put you in touch with the directors of these programs. So start asking. Begins with an ask. It won't happen if you don't ask.
Representative Tice.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Did you have additional testifiers, Representative Fenton? No?
Madam Chair, in the interest of time, I think we are good unless you'd like to hear from Channing Jones, who was on the list.
Okay. We are running a little short. Let's finish up member questions, and I think we'll move. Representative Peterson, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, my question is for Ms. Jones.
Oh, okay. Well, Ms. Jones, if you want to come down quickly. Thank you. Thank you very much. And if you please just identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Channing Jones, Madam Chair, and I'm the administrator of the Minneapolis Residency Program.
Excellent. Representative Peterson, go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you. And I guess I needed somebody from the University of Minnesota, and I was just looking at this brochure that you passed out, and on the bottom it says that the University of Minnesota will not be running a new 2017 cohort for Teach for America program, that you have an alternative pathway to teaching, and I was just wondering why.
Madam Chair, if I could, I would let Laura Mogelson from the University of Minnesota answer that question.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Yes. Thank you. If you please just state your name for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Laura Mogelson. I'm from the University of Minnesota.
And do you need the question repeated?
Why are we not running a 2017 cohort of the with Teach for America and the Alternative Pathway to Teaching?
That was it.
We had to make that decision for financial reasons. The numbers of enrollment, the enrollment numbers were very low, and we could no longer sustain the cohort across four licensure areas.
Other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could we get Ms. Jones to talk more about the Minneapolis residency? And I'm not sure, where did your initial funding come from when your program began?
Yes. Ms. Jones, why don't you go ahead and just tell us a little bit about the program in Minneapolis.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. The Minneapolis Residency Program is a collaboration between Minneapolis Public Schools, University of Minnesota, and MFT 59, the Teachers Union. Mm-hmm. The mission of the program is to create a pipeline to licensure that will diversify the teaching core and positively impact student achievement and engagement in a way that's responsive to student, community, and district needs. Our current student population in Minneapolis Public Schools is comprised of 65% students of color. By comparison, the licensed teacher core is only 17% teachers of color. Basically, our students are not seeing themselves represented in the front of the classroom. However, the unlicensed support staff in Minneapolis Public Schools mirrors the student population at about 65% educators of color. The educators are very dedicated to Minneapolis schools. They've been working in a support staff role, and many of them actually come from the community that they are serving. Unfortunately, as Ms. Robley expressed, there are a lot of barriers to receiving the license, and this program was designed specifically to reduce some of those barriers, the barriers predominantly being time and money. We created this pathway with the University of Minnesota providing a reduced tuition rate. And our funding, much of it came from in that first year integration funding that the district receives, as well as we received a grant from Minnesota Comeback. The district continues to invest in the program with the integration dollars because our emphasis is on diversifying the profession and specifically working with our racially identifiable schools.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you said that the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers contributed just initially, or are they ongoing contributors to your program financially?
Ms. Jones.
Madam Chair, actually, the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers is a supporter of the program. They don't contribute financially. They were able to support in some of the gatherings that we've had because they're very supportive of the educators and getting them to be licensed teachers. That mostly came in the form of dinners when we got people together, but they are a big help when it comes to recruiting non-licensed staff for the program.
And yes, one last question. Mm-hmm. So the paraprofessionals who move into your program, are they coming with bachelor's, associates, or less than that?
Ms. Jones.
Madam Chair and Representative, our program is currently open to support staff that have a bachelor's degree similar to St. Paul's program. As Fadouma mentioned, there is a need, and as we look to grow, because residency programs will continue to evolve based on the need of the district and the needs of the students, and I definitely foresee that there needs to be a pathway for educators that don't yet have a bachelor's degree. As we're starting now, we've been able to find a rather diverse group of residents that have that bachelor's degree, but I do agree, I've met a lot of wonderful support staff that don't yet have that degree, but still would be a wonderful contribution to the classroom.
Madam Chair, indeed a challenge for us that we should look to. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. And with that, we're going to have to move on to our next presentation, so I'm going to let Representative Fenton have the last word. Thank you so much. Wonderful testimony.
That's good.
Very excited for all of our teachers and teachers-to-be who presented today. Thank you. Representative Fenton?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I renew my motion to move for House File 1380 to be laid over. As you heard today, there clearly is a need, and I think room for expansion across the state, and this is a great program, and it's new, and I encourage members to continue the funding to help this program grow and expand throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Great presentation, and with that, I renew my motion, House File 1330 be laid over for possible, 1380, Chair needs to wear her glasses, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. All right, thank you. So now we're going to move on to House File 1255, and this is a bill that I am sponsoring, but we're going to hear on an informational basis today, so I won't be making a motion. But I do, as testifiers come forward, I just want to say that one of the topics and areas of focus I've been pleased to work on in the last couple of years is understanding the critical needs of our intermediate schools and the co-ops that are serving our special education students that are, you know, federal level four or those with severe needs that are referred to the intermediates and the cooperatives for the type of service provide. I've spent extensive time touring, and it has been a very eye-opening experience for me and for anyone else who has toured them. And they are facing unique and very difficult challenges. Many of the students referred to them have extreme mental health needs, behavioral and emotional issues, and in many cases some of those needs have resulted in injuries to staff, and it's happening with increasing frequency. So we've provided last year in the supplemental some additional money for training for staff. And as I explained then, and I feel now, it's a Band-Aid approach to what we're doing in these schools and the help we're able to offer. So, the intermediates have been really wonderful at stepping up and trying to put forward a larger proposal to think about the types of services that are offered to students and how we really bridge that gap of providing not only education, but really mental health services in to some degree for the students who need it at these schools. So so the bill is upon their recommendations and study and ideas that they put forward. So with that, I'm excited to have you all here and to have you talk about what's in the bill and how you came to develop those recommendations, and then look forward to a good dialogue with the committee members. So, Ms. Lewandowski, are you going to lead off? All right. Thank you. And thank you to all the testifiers, and if you'll just say your name before you start your remarks, we'll have that on the record. So, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandra Lewandowski, and I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287. My school district serves 12 schools, school districts in the West Metro area. And each day I have over 600 students who come to us in order to participate in a segregated full-day special education program in five different sites. Most of these students are referred because a member district can no longer meet their severe behavioral needs and or they need a very customized learning space. They most often require one-to-one adult supervision. Most have experienced significant trauma and or have a diagnosed mental illness. As a result of their backgrounds, they often present to us with aggressive behavior and often injure themselves or others. I'd like to share one profile. This student is the student who I met 2 weeks ago when I went to one of my schools to support free staff who had been injured the day before. This secondary age student is of average cognitive ability and has a diagnosis of autism. She is a bright young woman with a passion for animation and fan fiction who cares deeply for her friends, her family, and her classmates. However, since she began with us in the fall of 2014, her mental health and daily functioning has significantly deteriorated. Staff often observe that when given a direction, she will often engage in verbally and physically aggressive behavior. She will curse and yell at staff and often engage in physical tantrums during which she will fall on the floor and pound her arms and legs. Of significant concern is her distorted thinking, which does not always seem to be based in reality. Frequently throughout the day, she will engage in suicidal thoughts and make suicidal comments, such as, I don't want to be alive, I'd be better off dead, and I'm definitely going to kill myself today. On more than one occasion, she's grabbed a pencil, held it up to her neck, and threatened to kill herself. Moreover, her mother reports that she's not safe in their home due to repeated attempts to harm the family. Given her mental health condition and significant safety concerns in the school environment, she was able to access some community supports and eventually was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. She was hospitalized and was discharged with the medical recommendation of attending a residential treatment program for more intensive evaluation. However, due to her insurance and their reluctance to pay for the very high cost of residential treatment, she was discharged with no mental health services in place. Since that time, her mother determined that the best option for her was to return to school. The day I arrived, this young woman had been back in school for 6 days. Since that time, she engaged in suicidal and homicidal thoughts on 4 separate occasions and had been sent by ambulance to a local hospital to address her significant safety concerns. As I entered the school, our social worker, school resource officer, and 2 EMTs were coaxing her into the ambulance for yet another emergency room trip. Although her school team is doing the best they can to program for her and meet her social, emotional, and behavioral and academic needs, the team is profoundly limited in its scope and capacity to meet her severe and persistent mental illness. The last years in my many years in education have been the most disturbing and, frankly, the most dangerous. The truth is that intermediate schools are the front line of the children's mental health system and increasingly the front line of juvenile corrections. The risk to the safety and well-being of our staff and students has never been so high. They are real and they are becoming more severe each day. My population of students is changing drastically. In the past 3 years, the number of students with highly aggressive and sexualized behavior has doubled. We are on alert every day, all the time, including all of our students in both our special education program and area learning center program. This totals approximately 1,000 of the highest need students in Hennepin County. When we exhaust all options within our reach to serve a student, we seek lifelines from hospitals, treatment centers, and other providers. More times than not, students are turned away because their behaviors are too dangerous or a myriad of other barriers that get in the way of them getting the help they need. So most often, they return to school, often the next day, and schools simply can't say no. As a superintendent, my greatest responsibility is to keep students and staff safe, and yet my greatest fear is the potential of significant injury as a result of the trauma and mental illness our students bring through the school doors. The warning signs are there,
And unfortunately, the question is not no longer if it will happen, but a matter of when. On February 9th, I had an incredible day. In a single school day, we juggled five critical incidents at various schools that resulted in two of my staff being injured. One of these staff, you may have heard his name, he was the Minnesota Educational Support Professional of the Year this year, Marcel Branch. After trying to break up a fight between two students, he was taken to the ER for blunt eye trauma, strain to the retina, and a possible fractured eye socket. Throughout the day, two students were arrested, eight squads responded to a single mental health emergency, and another student attempted to commit suicide at school and was taken to yet a different hospital. And yet another was charged with second-degree assault after stabbing a staff member in the stomach with a pen. The day was tough, but it was not unique. Earlier this year, I was disturbed to learn that one of our Area Learning Center students was charged with murder, and a second student was arrested in relation to a separate murder. When the police came to school to arrest them, they had been in our classrooms, and one had even just minutes before provided a tour to several school board members. I'm sad for these students. We know them to be hard and resilient learners, and I'm sad that as a society, we have failed them. We know our ALC students, and especially our special education students, are entitled to their considerable state and federal protections under the law. They deserve a public education and a mental health system that allows them to reach their potential. We desperately need your support to adapt to this new reality that intermediate schools are serving school students with such high needs. So are the best minds in our intermediate districts came together at the end of the last legislative session and worked to better define a system that we thought would be more effective and changed both the landscape and trajectory for our students. Our vision for this, for our students, the ones who have severe behavior and mental health challenges, is for a school, our schools, to be a place where education and mental health treatment are integrated, where teachers and mental health providers work together, and where a student can seamlessly move between a math lesson and mental health therapy, in order that the students can be met where they're at, when it matters the most in school, and by staff whose skills and training match this needs. Transformations like this take an investment. The return on one is critical, and although we can't put a price tag on the young lives, we have the potential to change. We are confident our efforts will pay off with fewer mentally ill youth ending up in adult jails, fewer sexual offenders, and safer communities for all of us. In this bill, we ask for your help in several areas. First, we're asking for support for mental health grants to assist intermediate districts that provide instructions to the students whom I just described. Secondly, we are asking for additional funding for our area learning centers where we serve students with significant needs. Third, we are asking for sustained professional development dollars to train our teachers and staff on managing significant behaviors and safety. The role of our educators reach far beyond their current training. We need them to have the skills to manage the types of behavior that are increasingly present, students with sexualized behavior, mental illness, and violent aggressions. This bill, we believe, would help build capacity and provide training and consultation not only for us, but for our member districts. Finally, we'd like to have an accountability study of this initiative to determine the efficacy of its use. In other words, the efficacy of an integrated, equally embedded school treatment setting. In closing, what our schools do extends far beyond the scope of what any of us ever imagined or planned for. We need your support, we need adequate resources, and we need to adapt now. We need to adapt our schools to the needs of families and students who need it the most, and we believe our bill can help meet this new reality. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Lewandowski, for your testimony and for all of the effort that you've put into helping to craft this proposal with your colleagues. Why don't we just go ahead and hear from the testifiers, I think, and then we'll open it up to questions unless someone has something you want to ask immediately. Cliff Carmody, Mr. Carmody, are you next?
Thank you, Representative Loon. I am not from an intermediate district. I represent a rural service cooperative. I think it would be appropriate to say that we're much more like an intermediate district in rural setting than we are a service cooperative in many aspects. I'm the executive director. We serve 55 public schools in southwest and west central Minnesota. To give you a little bit of idea what the geography is, if you know where Ortonville is, Big Stone Lake, in the hump, on the western edge, you go over to Glencoe, Silver Lake, Lester Prairie, and you go south to Jackson. We cover those 18 counties. We have five programs where we work with setting for or behavioral kids, high needs behavioral kids. None of those programs are the same. It's a challenge for us, and so too often some of our children have to be on a bus for between 70 and 80 miles one way to access programming in our region. Geography matters for us in the rural setting. We have the same issues. I think the stories that Superintendent Lewandowski was sharing with you could be repeated over and over, not probably as often as they do with the intermediate districts, but certainly with the same kind of emotion and concern that she shared with the committee. We, as soon as yesterday, I was in a conversation with a group of superintendents in Worthington, Minnesota, and they were asking each other, are you seeing mental health needs for really young people, kindergarten students, first grade? And the answer is yes, we are. It's growing exponentially. Our programs are growing exponentially. We are looking at expansion. The challenge with expanding our programs is really twofold for the most part. It's square footage or access to space to provide the programming and the access to teachers and services. We talk often and probably too often when we look at our facilities because location matters. Today, two of our five programs are in small communities. We tend to look at small, most often elementary schools that have been vacated by a local school district. They work really well for our programs. That has its own set of challenges. But one of the key principles we're looking at in our facility studies, we look for expansion, is access to law enforcement. And in these two small communities, it can take anywhere from 15 to 20 to an hour for law enforcement to respond when we call, simply because they don't have city law enforcement. We're depending on the county. We often talk about with our teachers. In fact, our board members are very concerned about the safety and welfare of our staff, teachers and paraprofessionals. And one of the things that I thought I would never have to do in negotiating in a more traditional school setting was to talk about how we can reimburse staff if and when they get their glasses broken or they get assaulted by one of our students. These students are challenging. Our school districts need these programs, and this bill will allow us to better serve students with mental health needs, to better serve our ALC students. In 2015, when the law changed, we had a very robust program for our students in our alternative school, and I call it a skinny ALC now. We're basically doing a credit recovery, whereas before we were working on career and technical education opportunities for these kids to help them become what they wanted to become, pathways to not only the job market, but to two-year colleges and universities and four-year colleges and universities. Our goal was to give them opportunities to be able to go where they wanted to go. So the problem is not just a metro problem. The challenge is also in our rural districts. The largest district that I represent is 4,300 students, and then some of the smallest are under 100. So it's real. I'm here, again, to support this bill. I'm also here to thank my colleagues from the intermediates in inviting us to this event. I think we have, as Sandy said, we have significant issues, significant challenges, and there's a need that's going unmet, and I would thank you for your consideration of this bill. It will make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carmody. Heather Cronin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Heather Cronin-Ott, and I'm a teacher and autism specialist at Connor Blue Education Center in the Northeast Metro Intermediate District 916. I'm also a part of 916's consult team. We partner with our member districts to assure early and appropriate behavioral interventions. This ongoing collaboration supports students and helps them maintain placement in the least restrictive educational setting. Nevertheless, some of our students require Level 4 services, and some pose unique mental health challenges. For my students who are in a Federal 4 setting placement, I want to advocate for school-led mental health funding and partnerships with mental health agencies. We seek your assistance in creating a multidisciplinary team of highly skilled educators and mental health providers to meet the complex challenges of our students' mental health needs. Please support this legislation and help us provide integrated education and mental health services for our students. I work with a student who was recently hospitalized due to his mental health issues. He's a 9-year-old child with a label of intellectual disabilities and autism. This child was physically and verbally threatening his own life while at school. His aggression toward himself and his unstable mental state meant that he was at great risk, and our staff was also at risk, both physically and emotionally. For instance, he said, "I want you to kill me. I want you to hit me. I want you to punch me, and I want you to cut me." This 9-year-old child had actions consisting of biting, hitting, pinching, kicking, headbutting, and slapping. He was spitting blood, and it was unclear whether it was his or that of an adult he had bitten. He kept trying to tear off his skin with his mouth while headbutting a cement wall. He tried to use his fingers to pinch and pull the skin off of his body, and he finally started to target his own eyes and teeth. Staff, they felt helpless because seclusion was not a safe option for him, and he was almost impossible to restrain physically, even for short periods of time. He's a 9-year-old child. He's this tall. We called county services. They came, and he was taken to the hospital where he stayed for several days. He returned to school, and we had no treatment plan to follow should a crisis like this occur in the future. But I want you to know there's hope here, because upon returning to school, he was asked, "What were you feeling? Can you please tell me?" And this is what he said to his staff. He said, "I ran out of space. I ran out of space in my brain. It wasn't really working very well." And then this 9-year-old child looked up and said, "I'm having a good day today." In a school population that is dominated by students with emotional behavioral disorders, intellectual disabilities, autism spectrum disorder, and various mental health needs, there is hope for those students with complex and intense needs. We work hard, really hard, to help our students become educationally successful and socially integrated. Sometimes that requires our students and teachers to deal with the most stressful mental health challenges where we work, at our schools. We recognize the value of outside mental health interventions, but it is necessary to incorporate these interventions into our setting and in a cooperation with our staff whenever possible. We need to assure continuity of care following mental health crises. The legislation you are considering would be a positive step in that direction. You, all of you, can increase my students' chances of being well and being successful community members by supporting this legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cronin. Rhonda Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rhonda Warner, and I have 3 sons. Today I'd like to talk to you about my son, Gunnar. In many ways, Gunnar is a typical 7-year-old boy. He loves to be outdoor. He loves hockey. He is really a sweet little boy. He has a fun personality. He likes to go to the library or the apple orchard. He loves to go to the community center and play basketball. He also loves to play basketball and hockey games on his iPad. That part of our journey with Gunnar mirrors life with his 2 other brothers. But we have a more complex journey with Gunnar. Gunnar has many challenges as part of his disabilities. As of September 2015, he now has a number of diagnoses, including
attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, disruptive impulsive control and conduct disorder, language disorder, anxiety disorder, and disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. We do not know all these diagnoses when he and his twin brother joined our family when they were 9 months old. We knew we had challenges, and so I began advocating for him right away. Gunnar had been a ward of the state. We learned that Gunnar's birth mom was a meth addict. She also had issues including ADHD, panic and anxiety disorder, and two mental health issues, which we know can be hereditary. We have learned that he does not have fetal alcohol syndrome, but he does have a processing disorder from the meth exposure. He has severe auditory and sensory issues, so loud noises bother him. We have learned how to do joint compressions and have a brush to brush him to help calm him. He has trouble being out in public. Sometimes he does not like large crowds and does not like a lot of noise. Gunnar has been on an IEP since he was 9 months old. He had extensive occupational therapy and speech therapy before he started school. When it came time to plan for kindergarten, the school planned on telling us if he could continue with the kindergarten center by the end of October. However, it took until March for them to decide that they did not have the capabilities to teach Gunnar in the kindergarten center. So they enrolled him in a level three school, but then a month later they called and said they didn't have the capabilities to teach Gunnar there either, and they wanted to enroll him at Connor Blue. So he moved to Connor Blue at the end of kindergarten. One big problem for us was that lapse of time, that 9 months that Gunnar lost by being singled out and put in a room by himself because he could not handle being in a classroom with 26 to 30 other kids. So we lost all that time. I wish that that did not have to happen. I feel that Gunnar lost an important part of his education because of that lapse. He's doing better at Connor Blue, and we are grateful for his services there, but the struggle has been to get him a psychiatrist and trying to figure out all his diagnoses, and trying to get people on board to help us with his challenges. Had the school had the knowledge sooner, Gunnar would have been happier, and we as parents would not have struggled so much. Eventually, with the help of the staff at Connor Blue, we were able to get him in a partial hospitalization program, and the best thing that came out of that was access to a psychiatrist. But they released him only after 3 weeks in that program. The only value I felt was getting the access to that psychiatrist, which led to his neuropsychological evaluation. Gunnar now takes 4 different medications. The mornings are the worst because all the meds are out of his system. He has some tics where he will screech or squeal, and it is ear-piercing. And then his behavior gets a little rough with the animals or with his brothers. He is very hyper. His impulsivity without meds is 99.9%. It is the highest the psychiatrist had ever seen. So he's very often off the wall, basically untamed. We have had to wait to give him the medication so that he has more benefit from the meds when he is in school. So in the morning, it is helping him calm the waters, sit with him. Sometimes you can rub his back or brush him to help him calm down. But it is a lot of redirection in the morning. In school, he is challenged with outbursts, but when the meds start to wear off, he starts to lose it. He's overly hyper, lashing out at children, saying things he would not say had he been medicated. They give him more medication at school, but it does take 20 to 30 minutes for the drugs to take effect. When he is dysregulated, he does not like being that way. I know he wants to do better than that. With all of the meeting and clinic appointments, we have struggled with our jobs. Thankfully, we have wonderful bosses and a great company that we work for that have allowed us some time to get Gunnar to his appointments. Other families are probably not as lucky as we are. If Gunnar's services could be centralized so that he and other children that have a lot of needs could get more of what they needed while in school, all the service providers could consult with one another, coordinate, and it would be even better for my son, Gunnar. Our psychiatrist told us that Gunnar could maybe go to college, but may never live away from home. That was eye-opening but not surprising to me. I am hopeful that he will be all he wants to be. I hope he grows up and learns how to self-regulate and deal with the issues he has, and that he will become more self-aware. I just want him to be happy and succeed in his life. I want him to do something he is passionate about. He is all about hockey right now, but he needs to figure out what he can and cannot do, and I will be there to support him. Thank you for listening to my story about Gunnar. He's a great kid, He needs all the help he can get at Connor Blue and much, much more. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Warner. I especially appreciate you being here. And is it, do we have, like, questions? Right. So, are you here to testify? Okay. Please come on down.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Gwen Johnson. I'm an occupational therapist that works at Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. I've worked for them for 26 years. As the intermediate district, we cannot turn students away that have already been turned away by other support systems due to their violent and extreme behavior and mental health conditions. We are in a new reality, and we're getting into a crisis state. We, as an intermediate district, are the last hope for these children. We are shifting from being an active learning environment to a mental health holding facility. On November 7th, 2013, I suffered a severe concussion from a 9-year-old girl who was traumatized from being homeless and abused. Within an hour, I was unintelligible. I lost my motor coordination in extreme pain and had light and auditory sensitivity. I continue to suffer from frequent headaches and migraines today. Unfortunately, my story is not unique. Many staff that work with children with such high challenging behaviors like her are experiencing the same type of injuries that I have suffered. Fortunately, with the right mental health support and a talented education team, this girl has been able to gain the skills and the support necessary to be reintegrated back to her home school. Every student can find success, and I want to share with you a positive story about a 5-year-old young man who came to our district at 916 with severe aggressive behaviors, which include throwing furnitures, hitting, kicking, biting, scratching, stripping off his clothes, urinating, defecating, throwing bodily fluids at staff. Initially, he could only tolerate 2 hours a day in an isolated, low-stimuli environment. After 6 weeks of being with us, his mother came back to us and said for the first time she was able to take her son out and do a normal family activity. He is now 15 years old, and with the right programming and with the right resources, this child is now going to school all day long. He's in a special education classroom. He is actively engaged throughout his whole day, and we are able to take him out in the community. It takes a strong team and a strong unity and mental health support to get our students to be able to get to this level. And ultimately, it decreases the cost to educate them, as well as pass their public education. In conclusion, it is difficult to describe what we go through and work with every day at our jobs. The intensity of behaviors that are displayed by our students and the potential of harm, of irreversible harm to themselves, to other peers, and to other staff. However, I have seen with the right resources and the right support, right training, we can provide these students with a safe learning environment that will allow them to learn, teachers to teach, and families to flourish.
I've seen the impossible become the possible. I plead for you to support this bill. It is a critical resource that we need to accomplish this. Thank you, Madam and Chair, for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johnson. We really appreciate you sharing your experience and information with us. Are there any other testifiers? Everybody? Okay. Ms. Averholden, did you want to come down?
Thank you. Well, this chair is very low. Thank you, Madam Chair. members of the committee.
You can swap it out with the other one if you wish. So we do that all the time.
Sue Averholden, executive director of NAMI Minnesota, usually a little taller. I just wanted to, because many of you are not in human services, just put this in a little bit of a perspective to also talk about the need to continue to build our mental health system. We have not done much in the area of early childhood and trauma. We have a very tiny program in the state, and clearly when you've heard the ages of some of the children, it really is important that we start much earlier than we frankly do. I know that your committee has been very supportive of School Linked. This is kind of a more intensive approach than our current School Linked programs. As you know, in 2015, you passed legislation so we could begin to build psychiatric residential treatment facilities, which are a higher level of care than we currently have in the state of Minnesota. You may not know that we are looking at losing all of our federal Medicaid dollars for our current children's residential programs, and so that is something that if we lose those dollars and the state doesn't come up with them, we're going to be looking at counties trying to come up with those dollars, and we could lose, frankly, all of our residential treatment programs, or many of them, in the state of Minnesota. You also need to know that mental health parity has really not been implemented, especially along the lines of intensive in-home services. So if you have private insurance, chances are your insurance will not pay for someone to come into the home to really help those children succeed at home and, frankly, at school as well. And then we know that workforce continues to be a huge issue. We know we have a shortage of child psychiatrists. We have actually known that we have a shortage for many, many years. The first report of a shortage of child psychiatrists was made by President Eisenhower. This is an issue we have known for a long time and clearly have not done much about. I also want to say that we are also looking at kids that are far more complex. So it's typically not just anxiety and depression or even bipolar disorder or even early onset psychosis. It's also coupled with FASD and autism and just a number of things, which then makes it, frankly, even harder. And when you look at younger kids, they have even less ability to kind of control their emotions or know how to respond. And so I think that's when we've looked at even at the seclusion restraint data, it tends to be kids that are younger and not necessarily in high school. So there is a need really to continue to build our mental health system to really help the intermediates and co-ops as well figure out a way to couple that better than we are doing. But I just wanted to just kind of add that perspective to this discussion today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you doing that. And yes, this is a topic that really crosses, I would say, probably jurisdictional boundaries into HHS. But this, you know, as I've delved into this a bit, I mean, the fact is that if parents have no other avenues, if they don't have, their insurance does not allow for treatment, or there's something else going on, the kids have the right, every parent has the right to have their child in school, and so that's where the kids go. And I wanted to ask perhaps you, Ms. Cronin, or Ms. Lewandowski, whoever wants to take it. One of the things that has struck me when we're talking about special education services and that is that I presume when you trained, and Ms. Cronin, I don't know if you're a special education teacher.
I have a master's degree in licensure in autism and developmental disabilities.
Thank you. So did your training include what you needed to prepare you for the type of work you're doing? And that was one of the reasons that I pushed for additional money for training for staff for the intermediates, which was in the supplemental bill, the grant, was that we really have special education schools, but our in many cases functioning as sort of a frontline mental health facility as well, whether you were trained for that or not.
Yes, this is Heather Cronenot. So I can say that as a special educator, my master's degree and my licensure in special education, not only did it not really relate to mental health issues broadly, it didn't even really relate to academic issues broadly. I mean, we sit as special educators and question whether we're highly qualified sometimes to teach reading, to teach math, because we're special educators. Because what we're meant to be doing is working in schools with generalists. But the reality is that we aren't, and some of us aren't. And so we take it upon ourselves to educate ourselves in academics. I go to trainings on mental health probably more than in the last 10 years, more than anything else. So, no, my degree did not prepare me for the job that I'm doing in terms of how I respond to student mental health needs. But the fact that I work for an intermediate district has prepared me. You know, they are very supportive in my professional development. And I've worked in intermediate, I've worked in St. Paul, I've worked places. And I have to say that this is probably one of the most supportive. And I'm thankful for that because of the high concentration of students who have very complex needs.
Ms. Lewandowski?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would answer that question by saying that just yesterday our leadership team brought in Dr. Tim Wright from Village Ranch. Dr. Wright is probably, if not the top, he's certainly one of the top experts in Minnesota in sexualized behavior. And he explained to us, because we are seeing such an increase in kids coming to us with sexualized behavior, that virtually every paraprofessional and licensed staff member should be going through a pretty extensive training and professional development in that area in order to understand the students, understand one's own reaction, and therefore be able to successfully respond to behaviors we see. So that's an example that I would have never even occurred to me as a superintendent just 5 years ago, and now the recommendation is that we extensively train our staff in that area.
If I could say one more thing, this is Heather Cronin again. I think our teacher training programs provide us with extraordinary information on how to deal with behavior. Right? And behavior is something I'm well schooled at dealing with, but mental health is different. It adds nuances to human behavior that doesn't fit the model that I've been taught. Thank you.
Mr. Carmody?
Thank you, Representative Green and committee members. One of the things that I think is important to note, 20% of our staff working with these students with high needs are on some kind of community expert variance or otherwise have not had the training in a program to prepare them to be a special ed teacher, let alone to be prepared for the work that they're going to do inside our setting for programs. We, if you've heard from our colleagues, we work extremely hard with the resources we have to make sure that our staff is prepared to work with these children. It's not enough. It doesn't do what it needs to do. And we expect that we're going to continue to see, if we're going to grow programs, we're going to continue to see, in order to meet the need, a need to use these variances, special permissions, community expert type licenses, because we can't get the licensed folks that are coming through those programs.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first, Mr. Carmody, since you're up there, you said you have 5 programs in 18 counties?
Yes. Mr. Carmody?
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, we have 5 programs in 18 counties.
Representative Thiessen?
Okay, so how long, and do people commute every day?
Mr. Carmody?
So when you mean commute, so we have staff that live all over the region, and they come to these programs to serve the students. The students come from all over the region depending on their needs. So, for example, we have an autism program in one of our sites that doesn't exist in another. So if a student geographically happens to live 75 miles away, which we have him right now, we need to transport that student 75 miles one way to that program. We are right now in the planning stages of trying to establish a program or similar programming in all of those locations. But as I mentioned in my testimony earlier, square footage for facilities and licensed staff is a huge challenge for us.
Representation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you mentioned something about something happened in 2015, and I'm new to the committee. So I'm
Mr. Carmody.
Madam Chair, Representative, in 2015, the ALC laws were changed that restricted the amount of funding that came to service cooperatives in the intermediate districts and other cooperatives, so that I believe the funding that's received today is actually less than the general aid formula that a school district receives for that same student. So those students who have higher needs in many cases were receiving less funding, and so we had to reduce our costs, or I was given some advice from the Department of Education, or we could subsidize that somehow, or we could have the students come half-time or do something of that. Again, didn't feel like good solutions for students who already have very difficult challenges getting through a traditional school.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I have about two more, if I could.
Sure.
Okay. Just so to Superintendent, do you know who the insurance company was that denied the coverage, the treatment for that person?
Representative Lewandowski.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Lewandowski, I just called you representative. I'm sorry.
Yes, this is easier than getting elected. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do not know the name of that particular insurance company.
And Madam Chair, if
Representative Thiessen.
Do you ever see a difference between private insurance versus what public programs would cover? I mean, would public programs be more likely to cover that kind of treatment than private insurance?
Ms. Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, committee members, there certainly are some services that can be accessed more freely if a student is on Medicaid, but it's not universal. For example, with private insurance, you're more likely to get into a private psychiatric hospital for children, and because they don't accept many Medicaid children. So there's really advantages and disadvantages to both support through
Thank
insurance.
You. And then the last one, Madam Chair, maybe there's no answer to this. I mean, we had a little bit of testimony about, you know, fetal alcohol syndrome and autism increasing. But why, I mean, you're saying this increase in sexualized behavior. What's happening? Why are we seeing all of this?
Ms. Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, that's a very complicated answer and one that I certainly would not say I have an accurate one for. I can tell you that our expert yesterday, Dr. Wright, cited the myriad of social media that kids have access to is growing by leaps and bounds, and the kinds of things they're seeing on social media certainly is a factor from his standpoint. I would certainly cite that we are seeing an increase in kids with fetal alcohol syndrome, because we serve kids who have such complex and serious problems, what we're seeing is situations where they often need a very customized learning environment. And a few years ago, we maybe had four or five classrooms or spaces that were dedicated for one-to-one service for a student. We now have over 65. So that is a great, I think, set of data that shows the kinds of transitions we're in and the kinds of services we now are responsible for providing.
Thank you. Let's see. I'm going to go, Representative Thiessen, are you good for a moment? I know there's a lot of questions on this topic. Representative Erickson?
Well, Madam Chair, I wanted Mr. Strong to comment on that change in alternative funding that Mr. Carmody was referring to.
Yes. Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I'm going to double-check with the department on this.
There was a, formerly before the change, there was a requirement that a certain amount of funding be passed to the ALC, and that number was earned in as, I believe, 100% of the general education revenue. So I've got an email out to the department to check on this, but I think some districts may have been passing more than the 100% on, but I need to double-check that so I don't steer you wrong.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, I've listened very carefully to all the testimony that was given today, and we talk about the numbers of children in these programs needing much greater help at a much earlier age than in the past, and there are more children needing help from the beginning to throughout their childhood into adulthood. And I just wonder, are there programs that we ask the testifier if she had proper training for the job that she's doing? And are there even any programs that are available to go to increase your expertise to deal with these students, or do you have to do it through one person at a time like you did yesterday with bringing this expert in and then everybody listens to this expert? And are there just single people across the country, or are there is there any program in Minnesota where a teacher that wanted to work in an intermediate school district as part of a team could go and get qualified to become a team member?
Ms. Cronin.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, I think that there are lots of professional development opportunities for teachers to utilize. I think different districts provide different opportunities in different ways. Having worked in both St. Paul and 916 districts, I feel that the professional development that's offered through districts is quite beneficial. There's autonomy within the schools in some districts on what that professional development is. If you're talking about professional development outside of, you know, it's a special person that works in level four, and I think people come in and they either love it and want to stay for the rest of their career, or they come in and they go back into a less restrictive setting and go, I've got this. I'll be great. But there's always the Autism Society of Minnesota. I've gone to MOFAS, the Minnesota Organization of Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder. They have an annual event, an annual conference that happens. So going to those things and being allowed to go to those things by my district has helped me to better understand the mental health needs of my students. But that's not everybody. You can't send every teacher. You can't send, so it's difficult, I think, to some degree. Thank you.
Ms. Landowski.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, just briefly, I would say most of the staff who come to our district would say, I'm not prepared. Or their staff who've worked as paraprofessionals in our program, receiving community licenses and moving into the classroom, they feel more prepared. But I don't know of one single post-secondary option that you could go to and get a license and say, I'm ready to come to an intermediate. I don't know of any.
So, Representative Murphy.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and then you think about what Ms. Abderholden said could happen. So if we pass this, we're just touching another edge, right? And then if the stuff happens that Nami was talking about, what have we done? Where are we going? I was pretty happy before I came to this meeting. Now I'm more informed. And I'll have to worry all the way home for sure, because they'll be at the front of my memory, but the bill doesn't even hardly
scratch the surface.
Put the toe in the water.
No,
and then we have to learn physical coping techniques, too, from what was said, for protection and safety. And this is a really hard topic that we have to think long and hard and take all the advice we can be given to react.
No, agreed, Representative Murphy. And I think, I don't think this bill is a panacea for what I see.
And I didn't think you'd.
No, extreme concerns. And I think Ms. Aberholden brought to light some really important considerations in terms of, building out a mental health system in Minnesota, and just for the purposes of this committee for children. I mean, I know we needed to do that for adults and beyond, but for children. And unfortunately, right now, we've got a system that's really not in existence. And so what happens is these kids are sent to school, and then they eventually find their way to a level four facility. And so we're trying to figure out at least how we can try to offer some support and some better coordination of services that may exist, identifying where we need to go. Because I'm not convinced myself that that some of the children that we've heard described are in the care of these schools should be there. I think they should probably be in a mental health residential treatment. But in many cases, they're not. And so then what is the question. So I'm going to go to Representative Slocum, and then Mark Hughes. Mark Hughes wanted to offer a couple of words of testimony, and we will do that before we adjourn. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very quick. When you talk about Representative Murphy, when you talk about what kind of training, does a special ed teacher or any teacher get, realize that primarily, and I think I'm right on this, correct me if I'm wrong, most of the students that you serve in the intermediate districts came through due process through a standard district. Very, 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 very few are dropped into the intermediate boom right away. So they were in your classroom, and you know who they were, and you remember them. And regular ed preparation does so little also, like nothing. So I think we need to really look at how teachers are prepared, because they're not. And then I had a second quickie. We've touched on residential treatment. As an old residential treatment person, I worked there. and there used to be, that a kid would come and stay for 2 years, and we physically restrained, and we had kids that, anyway, it was pretty bleak, and we watched kids change and helped them change, but they lived there. And I think we have to look at, you have these kids for a limited number of hours during the day. You do everything you can to get them okay, and then you send them home to possibly, not all the time, but possibly an environment that stimulates the negative. And I think we need to look at that. And I know we cut residential treatments like dramatically because they're expensive. And, of course, we don't like to spend money on anything that's worthwhile. So, am I not? I made him laugh. But I think when you see the type of violence that you see in the intermediate, it's time to really look at where our buck is going as far as the residential treatment, and possibly expand to the more severe cases that you see in your intermediate district. Just an opinion.
Okay. Mr. Hughes, or actually, Mr. Representative Poston, if you have a quick question, then we'll go to Mr. Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. One of you said it takes a very special person to do what you do, and I just want to say that I think you are all very, very, very special. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you. I think you have encapsulated the views of the entire committee. It's exceptional, the things that you face every day. Mr. Hughes.
I'm Mark Hughes, and I wanted to thank you for having me on this committee today. It's really been an eye-opener. First of all, let me explain. I'm a special ed student myself out of St. Paul Schools of a long time ago, if you can't jump on my ear. Second of all, Sue Aperholden just spit out the facts. Even though she's sitting in the low chair, I told her I'd do her mind next time. But I want to tell you something, that I don't think when I hear people crying because they're homeless or there isn't a facility to help 75 miles away from here or any given place, I don't think you can blame the teacher. I think we have till midnight on the 23rd of May. I think we have to get somebody in here from the governor's office. I know he's big on education of all types, since he's East. I think we need to rethink this thing through and replan, because don't blame the teachers. I think that the whole scenario is not ready. And don't blame the teacher, because it's only going to come down on the students, and the students are tomorrow's future. We need to really take a look at this whole thing. Listen to what Sue Abdenolden had to say and some of these other folks. You know, why isn't there a place closer than 75 miles away from where it needs to be? Why aren't these things set up? I know it takes money. I'm not stupid. But it also needs to be planned out. And so the state of Minnesota, the governor's office needs to be contacted now. We have the 23rd of May at midnight. I hope you guys will take a good look at this. Thanks for having me, Kestin.
Thank you.
Big issue.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. Ms. Lewandowski, did you want to say anything to close? Or did you want to say anything to close in closing?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I really appreciate the attention and the questions that occurred today. Representative Murphy, I'm worried every single day in my district. And anything that can be approved for this bill will help. You've heard the various ways, and we are very grateful for that consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll just close by saying that I certainly, and to Mr. Hughes's comment, this is not the fault of teachers. It's a system that doesn't work for a student population that this, the intermediate districts and the cooperatives and that are established, it's no longer adequate. Maybe it never was, but we have issues here that cross jurisdictional boundaries, that cross, you know, issues between healthcare, provision of healthcare, and the provision of education. And again, it is one of those tough things you grapple with. As you said, Representative Murphy, one of the new members to the committee, and I won't divulge which one, but came up to me on the floor after like the first couple of weeks of session and said, "Your committee is so depressing." Which made me feel bad, but at the same time, we all care about children. We care about our educational system. We care about the responsibility we have invested in us, and this is one of those really hard things to grapple with, but we have to do it. And to Ms. Warner, mom of one of these kids, kudos and prayers to you. And you found a place for your son where he's a few hours a day, but he's with you all of the rest of them. And I can't imagine that every day the love of a mom that it takes to get through and to make sure that your son is getting what he needs. So, it's wonderful, and I hope Gunner is enjoying the hockey season. He sounds like a marvelous little boy. So with that, members, we're out of time, but I want to thank you all for a great hearing, and we'll see you next week.